What's going on, everybody, and welcome to the Ask a CISP podcast. So this is the Thursday episode of The Other Side of the Firewall, where we talk about the latest and greatest of cybersecurity news, as well as we highlight those movers and shakers and glass ceiling breakers, those people of color who've made it to the other side of the proverbial firewall. My name is Ryan Williams, and I am joined by returning guests. So we have Kane back on the show from Hyperproof. Your title, again, is amazing. So field CISO for Hyperproof, and we had you on the show. I'm terrible with time. Time and
about
space.
A year. It's been about a year. Yeah, I think it's been about a year.
Wow.
And it was fantastic when I was on last year, and I see that your show's blown up and continue to expand. I saw that post that you put on LinkedIn recently about your first year of retirement, and that's blown up, and congratulations all the way around. You're doing amazing stuff.
No, thank you. Thank you. And it's great to have people come back on the show. So when we talked last time, we were kind of getting to know one another, exploring what Hyperproof is doing as a company, what you're doing within it, and then all of those really cool podcasts that you have, like the Drafting Compliance, which is beautiful title. Like, if I go back in time, I'm like, that's a good one. as well as, I know you're doing the 5-minute rundown as well of, I can't remember what that one is called off the top of my head, though.
Decided to call it Kane's 5 Under 5.
There it
and
is.
And then I also have my third property, which is InfoSec Pros, where it's kind of like this. Actually, I have smart people on, and I get to ask them questions, and they get an opportunity to talk about their backgrounds in cybersecurity.
That's awesome. So yeah, I have to catch up then. So three shows, one amazing host, and then also amazing company. So a little bit behind the scenes. So I worked for a company called Compliance Point. It was my first job out of the military. Love the company, love the people. And my first tool, my first ERC tool post-military was Hyperproof. So I used the Stig Viewer and the Gold Disk and all that good stuff when I was in the military. And not to knock it, but it's not as intuitive or friendly as what I experienced when I left the military. So that kind of blew my mind. I was like, people been using this all this time? Like, it's been
You're not wrong. I used to be a CISO at the Defense Industrial Base, and the tools that were previously available in the space have been and remain to be challenging to use.
Yes. It's more of like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's teetering on broken, but I digress. In case I ever want to go back to that space, I don't want to bash them too hard. But before we go too far, though, I just want to do a quick rundown. Like we've already had you on the episode. There's a really good hour-long episode with you breaking out your cybersecurity origin story and those initiatives. I'm sorry, a year ago. But if you could just do a brief rundown of who you are and what you currently do, and then we can start to go into catching up.
Fantastic. So, I remember that last show we did together. It was so much fun. Briefly, for those who are joining us at this point, I'm Kane. I'm the field CISO, Chief Information Security Officer for Hyperproof. I am also a senior member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers for my contributions to cybersecurity, and I'm also a spokesperson for the IEEE on cybersecurity. I have been doing this for nearly 30 years, I think, now in cybersecurity. I got my start at a consulting firm where I took my background as a college dropout of a theater program and took my background in improv and managed to turn that into a job. And since then, I've had the privilege of working across multiple continents, multiple industries, including, as I said, the defense industrial base, but also the commercial sectors and private sectors, public sector jobs. And I think I've played every job there is in cybersecurity, except for, we didn't call it red teaming, we called it tiger teaming back in the day. But I like to think that I've done most everything there is to do. And these days, I mostly spent a lot of time thinking about how fortunate I am when I entered the industry and how we can continue to have those opportunities for people to get into the industry without saying, hey, you need to be saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars of college and university debt and get yourself 6 certifications so you can get an internship.
Right. Absolutely. And I found that fascinating the last time we talked, just your background in general and how it was so amenable to what you currently do. A lot of people are like, how do I get into cyber? Do I have to learn something completely new? Like, yes, you will learn new things, but what are you bringing with you? What are those soft skills and those talents that you have from your previous history, your background experience? And I find it fascinating. People such as yourself who came into cyber with basically a talent that most people don't have in IT or cybersecurity. It's the ability to articulate and be able to tell those people above you, the C-suite, and what needs to be done, and also talk to the people who are at the technical level. And oftentimes, like not to bash IT folks, because I am one, right, after 20 years, but we don't really like talking to people. It's not our favorite thing to do all the time. So it's remarkable to see someone come into the space who brings that with them, that personality with them, and also is able to articulate to both sides. So I think if you're that type of person and you're interested in cybersecurity, I think there's definitely an avenue for you, even though things are kind of in turmoil right now, right? It's not the best of times, not the worst of times. It's a coin a book, but it's definitely different.
Very fair assessment of where we currently are as the industry, but I think it's also right. important to take as inclusive of an approach as possible to cybersecurity, because I talk to friends who are, you know, attorneys, who are policy analysts, who are economists, who are in, you know, some people who are in cybersecurity still as well. And ultimately, they recognize that back in the 80s, when we were doing large-scale educational development and workforce development planning, we were thinking the problem was going to be rogue nuclear material from Russia. That was going to be the big macroeconomic global threat that we would be facing, not Russian threat actors producing disinformation and harboring ransomware threat actors who are consistently moving money from Western companies and countries to Eastern right. companies and countries. I don't think that we had the plumbing built in. And so I think if we keep doing what we've been doing, we're going to get the same results. So we really do need to pivot and find different approaches to take a more inclusive approach towards cybersecurity, but also make the workload of those in cybersecurity so that it's meaningful and they want to stay in the industry, as opposed to getting in, finding out how much bonus work that they hadn't expected that just sucks the joy out of your day, and trying to remove as many of those obstacles as possible so we have long-term workforce retention, not people who show up, get burnt out, and bail.
Right. No, and I think that's a great segue kind of to where I wanted to go. So it's like, tell you're a professional within the space. He's like, you know, I know where you want to go. I'm going to help you get there, right? So I appreciate the alley. So when it comes to providing the tools, so to speak, to help with that pipeline, to help people not be burnt out. I know Hyperproof is kind of tip of the spear within that regard. And you guys have a suite of tools, and this is not paid advertising. I'm not getting anything from it. I'm just going from experience. Like, I've used the tool. I've had the ability to give inputs as, you know, kind of a client of said tool, because I'm using it to conduct my assessments, whether it be NIST CSFs or helping with the healthcare team with HITRUST or an ISO 27001 or what have you. But it was already a great product when I started to use it, and then I saw its evolution before I pivoted, and now I'm back in the federal space, so we're not quite using that at this time, at least not in my current capacity. I'm sure other people are using it within the space, but for what I currently do, I'm not using it, and I do miss it.
Yeah, and I'm happy to be here. Part of the reason that and I'm glad that you had a positive experience using Hyperproof. Part of the reason that I came to Hyperproof was really as a former executive advisor, I'd watch how much time companies would spend trying to collect evidence that they could send to an auditor or to an external assessor to evaluate their cybersecurity maturity and internally how well they could do that. And I previously ran into that when I was a CISO at a defense industrial base company, where being able to positively affirm that you had your SPURS score, that you'd actually been able to figure it out before you'd submitted it, was very difficult and time-consuming on staff. And it resulted in that, like I said, that bonus work that sucks the joy out of your day, where inevitably the GRC team is saying, hey, could you send me a screenshot or maybe a log file or maybe a PDF showing that you're actually doing your job because we can't trust you because reasons. As a cybersecurity professional, that right. is degrading. As a person who's managed and led teams of cybersecurity professionals, you take a different approach of, wow, that is a time drain. And so what we've been doing at Hyperproof that I'm really proud of is automating as much of that evidence collection and evidence testing as possible. Because if you want to know that maybe, I don't know, let's say you're encrypting your S3 bucket's probably a good idea, having encrypted storage, being able to do that at scale without having a single person actually responsible for go out and check the S3 buckets. Can you imagine that as your day job? Like, go check the S3 buckets, go make an API call. It makes no sense. I think that in GRC, we made the mistake of forgetting that computers can copy files and computers can check stuff. And so we've automated most of that. And where we're going with it right now, actually, you mentioned you're currently with a federal adjacent or a federal job. And I just mentioned SPUR scoring. So part of the CMMC, the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, is being able to calculate your SPUR score and being able to have evidence of that. And that's something that we are working, I don't think it's released as of today, but I do know that it's coming out like immediately because I've seen it in action where an organization that's using Hyperproof can actually determine what is their SPUR score for a given program. And that's whether the program is associated with an enclave or a business unit, or maybe you're a prime or a sub to a prime and your entire contract is with the DIB. You're going to have that ability intuitively to do that without having to get deep into like StigViewer and some of the other tooling that you'd mentioned and didn't have such a favorable experience with.
Not trying to bash a product, like it's evolved over time. So I've used it for over a decade, probably close to two. It's just, it's the seeing the leap forward. So it's the going from horse and buggy to sports car is kind of the analogy where you're able to, I'm able to complete my job. I always say I've been the evaluator, you know, post-military as well as when I was in the military, but I've been the victim like my entire airman career. You're the guy who is, we need you to provide all the artifacts, you need to provide the evidence on top of your normal job. So do your 9 to 5 and then get us ready for the inspection. And then get us through the inspection and now do the cleanup post inspection. Mm-hmm. It's normally the way it's always done. So when I did retire from the military and I saw that there was other ways of doing it, right? Like you said, continuous compliance. So it's a tool that you can use to help monitor. It's a tool or a tool set, I should say, you can use to pull in the framework. So if you have multiple frameworks, that's also awesome. Again, I'm not being paid for this, although it sounds like an infomercial.
Right? You're doing great.
It's like the commercials where the person just is incompetent with what they're doing. Like, I guess in this one, I have like 30,000 spreadsheets up and Excels and trying to make it work.
Yeah.
But instead, you have one tool, and then it can also whether it be to your benefit or your detriment, is something that you can show to the client as well. Say, hey, this is what I'm seeing in real time.
The other thing that it gives is it gives businesses the ability to consistently see how effectively they're managing their risk. And one of my colleagues is our lead author of our IT benchmark survey. And for the entire 5 years that we've been running that, what we found is the number of companies that have a unified view of risk and compliance. So they are tracking their controls. They're actually associating their controls with the risks that they prevent or reduce the probability of or impact of, have less frequency of breaches. And it's correlation. It's not causation. But every year we do the survey, we find the exact same result. And it makes logical sense because if you're living in spreadsheet hell, if you've got 5 different spreadsheets with 5 different authors and 5 different formats, and you wonder, like, how come I can't figure out what my risks are, or which risks are important, or how effectively I'm managing them? It's that. It's that it's a fragmented view of reality. And so the value of a tool like Hyperproof is in getting that consolidated view. And one of the interesting things, if I can pivot to where I'm thinking of next.
Oh, absolutely.
So the funny thing that's happened in the year since you and I talked, because I was previously, I think I talked about tying controls to risks. Something that happened last year is the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC in the United States, started saying, okay, you all have to start telling us how you're doing the cybers. And they gave companies 4 right. factors that they had to report on in section 1C of the 10K. And because me, I like a train wreck just as much as the next person, I figured, okay, a whole bunch of publicly traded companies who have never had to disclose how they're doing cybersecurity have to talk about how they're doing risk management and how they're doing governance. And earlier this month, this is currently April, I published a blog article about the 11 factors that companies are actually reporting in their most robust disclosures. And the reason that I did that is because a lot of CISOs, you want to, when you're a CISO at a company or when you're a company's compliance officer, you want to kind of look like everybody else. You don't want to be too far out over your skis, but you don't want to be in the rear of the pack. You want to be somewhere in the middle. And so by learning how to read and then having read over 2,000 of those disclosures.
Oh, wow.
Which
okay.
I did. It's the weird life skill that I picked up this year. I found out those 11 factors that are actually in a robust 1K section 10 1C section 1K disclosure. And the funny thing is, I'm now working on a cohort analysis. So I've actually finished like collecting all of the 1Cs that I can get published between January and March. There's over 2,800 of them. And I'm finding in, you know, this type of company, here's what we will report for risk management. Like not all companies are reporting that they have CISOs, but of those that do, in some industries like software development, it's way overpronounced, whereas in something like oil and gas, there's no mention of CISOs or of regulatory frameworks or cybersecurity frameworks. And the reason I'm doing that ultimately is because like this is now gone and done. The blog's not up, but that's a matter of time. But we're all going to have to do this next year. We're all going to have to report on, if you're a publicly traded company, we're going to have to report on how are we managing our cybersecurity effectively. And what I'm really looking for is this year, some company is going to make an 8K disclosure that said they had a breach. And I expect the SEC is going to ask their examinations division, hey, could you go take a look at their Section 1C and their 10K? Mm-hmm. And the reason I think of that is that there was a couple of years back, there was famously a company that said, we have the best ESG. We've got the best environmental controls possible. And then a whole bunch of dams broke and they were breached. And a whole bunch of people actually died, which is a tragic story. And they were sued. And then the examinations division came back to that same company and said, so tell us about those ESG controls that you had that were the absolute best. And they were found to be lying. And again, you get materially fined. I think they've since declared bankruptcy. What I'm expecting will happen, and I wouldn't want to wish on anybody. I expect there's going to be some company out there that discloses a material breach because of what they put in their Section 1C will have a finding from the examinations division where they can't prove it. And that's where, again, why I'm at Hyperproof, because I want companies to be able to not only say they have these controls and to speculate and to give their opinion that they have these controls, but actually to be able to prove it. And not to be able to prove it at a point in time, which has been our classic audit mentality of like, hey, this one day the MFA was working. No, 365 days a year we had MFA, we had encryption, whatever controls you say that you have, to be able to go back to an auditor, even a regulator like the Securities and Exchange Commission or, I don't know, counsel from a lawsuit that you're facing, and be able to shut it down immediately, not spend staff time, not ask our analysts and our incident responders and our talented engineers, hey, sorry, in addition to doing the cybersecurity job that you're doing, like you said, as an airman, as your day job, by the way, we have to defend against the lawsuit. And so you get to work an extra 4-hour shift in your day doing evidence preparation and production for somebody, whether it's a regulator or an attorney, because nobody wants that as part of their job. It's terrible.
No. And it holds accountability. So it'll be the up to the C-suite. And hopefully the CISO as well, if they have one, or whatever their equivalent is, to be held accountable. Like,
yes.
Are you actually, are you practicing the way you're preaching? Like, is this actually the way you've been running said business? And there'll be evidence attached to it. So no, that's great. 2,000, that is a ton. I've read a handful.
You know, they gave me a lot of good memes for the past quarter on LinkedIn, a lot of funny things. And ultimately, I'm trying to roll it up to something so that the next time that the other thing that drove this really was the Tim Brown and SolarWinds thing. Like Tim Brown at SolarWinds, they engaged fully and wholeheartedly with the CSRB, the Cybersecurity Review Board, and gave a very robust disclosure of how, and this is before the SEC said, hey, you have to tell us how you're doing the cybers. This was before that happened. Like Russia rolled them quite hard. They made a robust disclosure. The SEC decided to litigate and file civil lawsuit against Tim Brown and SolarWinds prior to the new Section 1C requirement. What's it going to be like after that actually happens? I don't expect it's going to be any better or any friendlier. And if the SEC decides to go like, remember when GDPR first came out? It was all fines all the time, all the way down, because they had to prove a point. I think we're going to see that same motion, unfortunately, associated with this. So companies that are making those disclosures really have to be aware of being able to demonstrate compliance of what they said, not that they just have a really nice paper tiger.
No, absolutely. So that gives me several different things I'd like to jump into. But I guess the closest target would be, what do you think is going to happen with the role of CISO in the near future? Because right now it's kind of going through its evolution. You have people who say that it's everything. So these people are going to be held accountable. They're going to go to trial and have to defend themselves in the same companies that they don't have the ability to say what to do with the funds, to say that you have to file. There's no teeth, basically, in some right. companies. Do you think that this will allow the role to continue to evolve, or will it manifest or turn itself into something else at that point?
So I have a friend who's Swiss, and he calls CISOs in the United States an endangered species. And I do not think he's wrong. Last year, before the SEC enforcement of Section 1C was a thing, or the requirement, I should say, I read a study that said 75% of CISOs were considering leaving the profession because of Jeez. Mental health issues, because they weren't getting enough board-level alignment, because they were officers in name only, so they weren't on the right. D&O, they didn't have indemnification. And in a lot of cases, they were reporting downline. Like, if you've got a job title of CISO, and you're reporting to the manager of IT, you probably are in the wrong place. And I think what's going to happen this year as a consequence of this confluence of factors, we're going to get a reckoning of there are going to be CISOs who are CISOs who have the full backing, full-throated backing of their board, who have indemnification, who've got a legal defense fund where they can bring in their own counsel. They're on the D&O and so on and so on. There's a whole bunch of things.
Right.
And then there's going to be a whole bunch of people who find themselves something else to do with their day. I actually counsel a few CISOs as a mentor, and many of them are looking for other opportunities where they don't have to carry the title of CISO. And the reason why is the concern that by making a material misstatement or making a statement that at some point in the future later changes, they pick up a lot of civil liability. And unfortunately, the real trick to that is CISOs don't always own the means of evidence production. So inside right. of a company, there's usually the idea of a governance, risk, and compliance team, GRC team. They don't always report to the CISO. And yet the CISO carries an immense amount of civil liability associated with their role for a process and a team that does not report to them and whose means of production they might not have any way to influence. And the GRC team, they might not even know what good looks like. I can think of a customer I talked to of Hyperproof where they got rid of their GRC director because they realized they couldn't use Hyperproof because the person they brought in was a great auditor, they were a great assessor, great consultant. They had no idea of how to operationally run a GRC program. Mm. And so they had not built the plumbing to actually run at scale for a long period of time. And it wasn't a Hyperproof issue, it was a people issue. And I find that in GRC, if you don't come from one of the, you know, your classic big four, then you don't know what bad looks like, you don't know what good looks like. And consequently, people, you know, they go, well, I got a spreadsheet, and this is the way the last person was doing it. So I guess it must be good enough, right?
Right.
You and CISOs are, unfortunately, we are the ultimate target of that potentially broken process.
No, absolutely. I'm sure you're preaching to a lot of people in the audience right now who are listening. It's interesting to see. Like, I'm always optimistic, but I'm very optimistic about the new process and how it will continuously evolve how we protect not only the company and its clientele, but ultimately it's going to roll up into national defense. Right? That ultimately, like, cybersecurity is national defense. However, I'm just worried about, like you said, the casualties, like to see a mass exodus, because I would hate to be a person in their shoes as well. Like, okay, I'm going to be held, like you said, accountable for things that I have no control over or I don't have the backing. So hopefully that starts to lead in that direction. But the way the market currently is, I just don't know if next year is going to be the year.
I also can't stand idly by. I can't look at a problem and say, okay, that sucks, and yep, it's going to suck for everybody. So
right.
Something that I've started working on, and I've mentioned to a few of my friends, and I'll mention to you under the friend NDA, although I imagine I'm disclosing this to your listeners at this point. Hi, everybody.
Let's friends be too.
Friends. I'm actually working on a maturity model for governance, risk, and compliance. In my spare time, I have written a 170-ish page document trying to describe a roadmap for companies to self-assess where they are with GRC right now, what the possible four levels of maturity would be, moving from like a reactive to a proactive to an optimizing state, kind of like a NIST document, with the goal here of giving companies, first of all, visibility into what is everything in GRC, because you can't just say somebody, well, you should get better at governance, because that's like telling somebody you should get better at health. Like, what does that mean? Does that mean I should get better at eating? Should I exercise? Should I work out? Like, what? How do you? So I had to break it down into subdomains inside of each one of those. Still not sure I got it right, but I'm passing the document around to some of my friends who are CISOs and governance, risk, and compliance experts. My goal is to publish it this year so that we can have a rubric by which we can assess where our companies are at, and then how we can proactively get better so that CISOs are not ultimately the tip of the spear or ultimately having the spear pointed towards them for something that they don't control.
No, that is, it's going to be worth its weight in gold once that's complete, because there are a lot of companies, both large and small, they just have no idea, especially smaller businesses. They don't know where to start. I saw that a lot as a consultant, where it's kind of like, hey, we want to bring you on as a VCISO or what have you, but we don't know what to do next. So can you kind of give us an outline or a guide, basically? And I'm sure that scales up to larger businesses as well, because you see a lot of shuffle. You'll see people who leave who are kind of like that belly button. And then from there, it's picking up the pieces, like finding the artifacts on drives and things of that nature to kind of figure out where we're at and how we're going to move forward. And I think that's what's so cool about a tool like Hyperproof, is having that real-time kind of monitoring. You can kind of say, like, all these artifacts and things of that nature, like you said, like S3 buckets and things that can be automated, already being fed into that system. And then from there, it's a person can learn how the tool works and then kind of jump in and go from there. And it's the accountability factor. So it's not just the one guy or gal or whomever who is your belly button, which that tends to happen a lot in companies as well. Like when I'm doing an assessment, there might be a lot of people on the team, but there's always that one person that has like all of the knowledge. So this person can kind of work like a PM maybe and can dole it out to the right people and get the push they need.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think really with the way the world is going right now, where it's becoming far more litigious and far more regulated, and where the industry regulators are becoming far more prescriptive. Like I've heard CISA saying that they want this process to go faster, even though they're trying to work within the existing laws and regulations. They want the regulatory change to come faster. Companies are already struggling to keep up. And so there needs to be not only a core business function and software like Hyperproof to support it, but you also need to have people, as you said, to actually support it. You need to have that process documented so that it will survive staff changes when the proverbial belly button departs or is otherwise unavailable for a period of time, because we can't keep making this stuff up as we go along. I think that's been one of those things that a lot of companies, even grown-up businesses, like where you'd go, wow, must be adults running that place, they've been YOLOing. They just have been worried about what can we do today to make the shareholders happy. And that works to a point. But unfortunately, we're now bearing the brunt of those consequences of de-investment and deprioritization in basic core tenets like risk management, where I'm sure as you as an assessor and me as an assessor, like, we've probably walked into companies and asked them for their risk register or how they're managing risks or to give us some risk artifacts. And they go, say, what now? What is that? A neat idea. Tell me more. And I don't think that that's going to be the world that we continue to inhabit, or at least the companies that will survive and expand in this new heavily litigated, heavily regulated world. I think that's going to become just a normal part of business and a normal expectation. But I also don't think that you can't tell people, well, okay, you want to learn all this stuff, go take a 4-year college degree, right? And then go do your master's and then write your postdoc and you'll be able to have all of that knowledge. No, I think that needs to be democratized. That needs to be widely disseminated and it needs to be generally agreed upon and accessible. So those companies that don't have 4 years to send somebody off to go school on this can still actually make informed decisions and make positive change and continue to survive and thrive, as opposed opposed to falling behind, which I think right now is happening with some companies where they are falling behind the curve of not only do we have threat actors overseas who are working actively to either profit or to destabilize, depending on, you know, is it a nation state that's working to do disinformation and destabilize democracy, or is it just a criminal threat actor who's working to make a buck because, you know, that's their day job. Although actually the nation states, that's also their day job. But you've got that on one factor, and then you've got the regulators and the litigators who are also pushing for change. It's very hard for companies to keep up with this unless they've enshrined that discipline of GRC, of cybersecurity, and a very close tie between those two.
No, absolutely. And like you said, we don't necessarily have the time to build that pipeline. It needs... So we want qualified people. We want people who understand how things work. But at the same time, what I'm noticing is there's a lot of not necessarily just scope creep, but credential creep and education creep as well, where we want you to have 10 years experience, a master's degree, a CISSP, and give up a child or something like that. Right? We just we want the key.
It's about a $15 internship. I think you could probably get that. And that's unfortunately right. The job listings that you see and you want to burn the fire.
Right. It's, I think that it'll have to, at some point, it'll have to balance out. Like the market will have to correct itself because we just preached not too long ago, there was 700,000 vacancies in the states. And then shortly thereafter, we decided to let go of hundreds of thousands of people out there into the world. And it came the Hunger Games. So you have people who are that credentialed and you have people who are trying to get in and they're at odds. I mean, it works out to an employer's perspective in the short run, but like you said, in the long run, you still haven't fed these people into the system, and therefore, what's going to happen to you 3-4 years down the line when ransomware as a service, when disinformation as a service, and so on and so forth have matured even more? And I think that kind of leads into the AI conversation. I definitely would like to have with you okay. as well, because I think it. Double-edged sword.
I'm glad that we're 20 minutes in and we're 25 minutes in and we're finally talking about AI. I'm going to RSA later this year and I expect it's going to be the all singing, all dancing, all AI.
Right.
Like it was 10 years ago where it was all singing, all dancing, zero trust and no CISO ever wanted to hear that term again.
Yeah, they will beat things to death. Like the Air Force, everything was cyber for a while. Even my career field was called cyber transport. Everything, it was like Smurf. It was like everything was cyber. Uh-huh. But with that, being said, so I'm slow to the AI bandwagon. I finally arrived because I thought it was a lot of hype as well. I was just like, it's just they're using the term incorrectly. That's not what this is. But it actually is turned into what you know I wanted when I was a child. Right? AI and those large language models are actually becoming. Brains with personality, so to speak. You know, they're cutting down on time. So it's like the what was the future of tomorrow or the home of tomorrow where they showed robots and they had ovens that made food for you and they had tires that folded your clothes. Like we're actually getting to that point now where these tools are able to take away a lot of the mundane chores. So when it comes to the automation orchestration, such as a suite of tools like Hyperproof, how is that integration going? Because again, I feel as though it's a double-edged sword. It will get us there quickly. However, will it be leveraged in the correct ways? Like I know you guys will, you know, do your due diligence, but what are you seeing currently in the market? Like, is it being adopted correctly? Are you able to use it, or is it, you know, are you getting pushback, so to speak? Because a lot of companies don't even understand what AI is and they're scared of it.
Yeah, we actually did a study that going back to that IT benchmark survey that we do, and we found that most GRC professionals are currently using artificial intelligence and most GRC professionals are currently worried about artificial intelligence. And it is really that dual use sword there. And the way I look at it, we have customers who have taken artificial intelligence and used it to save time on reading information, on summarizing information. We've heard stories of people taking something that would take 8 weeks to digest all of it down to 8 days. And myself, I can relate to that because a lot of what I do in my day job and just in my off time is I read law journals and I read regulatory filings. And often I just want the point of it. I don't want to read right. the entirety of it. And I found that artificial intelligence is really good at summarizing information. And I think that is a possible use for it. And I have a friend of mine who's using artificial intelligence for privacy regulations. He and I are doing a thing in Seattle next week, actually.
Okay.
And he's got, there's not a lot of prior art for privacy regulations that are emerging, and he'll get control suggestions from an artificial intelligence to say, hey, don't write the control definition for me, but give me some ideas for what could work. Again, I think that is an acceptable use of artificial intelligence if you're using it to, hey, I'm looking at this control requirement. What could a potential control or controls related right. to this be? I think that's fair. Having said that, at Hyperproof, just we are not yet leaning in on artificial intelligence. I'm actually working on an AI council to do advice on how companies in our space should be doing artificial intelligence at scale and effectively and ethically. And the reason for that is that if you were to, I don't know, let's say you had an artificial intelligence that wrote your risk register, right? Let's take that as a for example. And your AI writes your risk register and it tries to develop risk definitions, risk impact assessments, and risk probability assessments. And perhaps it also tries to write up some controls to mitigate those risks. First of all, if you take that to a board and they ask you, where did this come from? They're probably going to laugh quite a lot when they tell you, you tell them that an artificial intelligence is telling you how to run their business. But also, if you take it to the other business unit leaders, how insulting is that? You didn't come to them and ask them what their risks were that they were facing. I don't think that artificial intelligence can ethically write a risk disclosure for a company. I also don't think that we could have those statements effectively, again, thinking of the SEC examinations division, like I could imagine they would love to get their hands on something that had been written as artificial intelligence, either as a risk assessment statement or as advice as to how a company is managing their role, their risks, whether they're cybersecurity risks or the risks associated with artificial intelligence. I think that that also is problematic. So again, at Hyperproof, we're taking a far more nuanced approach. We're looking at where artificial intelligence makes sense. Like if you want to perhaps brainstorm an idea for what a control could look like, sure, that might be a use case that we could consider. Do you want us to write you a policy document? I don't think you want an artificial intelligence to write you a policy document. I think you might want to get a second opinion on a policy document, like an ask a friend type feature, like what else is typical in a document, but not to have it produce that art for yourself. Because ultimately, the other thing that comes up, going back to my prior comments of how regulated we are right now as an industry across many, many industries, both public and private,
right.
Somebody has to sign that. Somebody's going to have to put their name on that. Somebody's going to have to actually ink it and say, I wrote this, or I am going to be held accountable for this. I don't think we have yet hit a point with artificial intelligence where people would feel comfortable signing a disclosure statement or some control definition that says, yeah, I totally did that. It wasn't an artificial intelligence, because if the AI made a mistake, here's the thing, the artificial intelligence provider is not going to be the person or the company that is affected by that mistake. It's going to be the person who signed the document and presented that work as their own.
No, absolutely. And I think that feeds into what is the best case for its use. And you bring up the perspective of an assessor or even from a consultant's perspective, right? So if I'm a consultant and I'm trying to lead a steering committee, right? I'm trying to get all the people from company A into the room to agree upon anything. Typically, that is a headache. That is several meetings that could have been emails. That was several meetings that didn't have to necessarily exist. And someone will have a good idea and they will reset us and we'll go back a step or two. What I would like to see from it would be, how do I utilize this to take all of that information, to take everyone's input, and as you said, kind of make an abstract out of it. Like where do these things overlap, and then find out the best way to build in the efficiency, because again, I'm with you. I don't believe that we're nowhere near the point where it can write policy and then ultimately someone have to sign for it. But I don't even know if that's the best use of it. I know people will try to go that route because you have people who are trying to develop books now with artificial intelligence. But what you quickly learn is that it wants to give you an answer. It doesn't necessarily care if you give it enough input. And like you said, if I were to go to all the different department heads and gather this information and start to build this grand policy, this grand guide or book or what have you, it can definitely help us to take all that marble and then chisel out, you know, the angel sculpture, as opposed to the opposite of it, trying to build something as though it's a human. It never turns out right. It comes out as a nightmare.
I do think there is promise in artificial intelligence when you think about large-scale signal analysis, and that's whether it's your classic SIGINT or whether it is cybersecurity, trying to filter the noise out of the signal. So if you're, and this is where it gets close to machine learning, and I think companies are going to be either very careful in this space or they're going to be the recipient of many lawsuits in this space, right, where the premise of artificial intelligence, setting aside generative AI, which is predominantly what we were just speaking of, the premise of it is if you have a threat actor that is conducting a sophisticated operation where, I don't know, let's say, you know, the Active Directory clipping rate is after 3 password fails, after 15 minutes, lock the account. Well, if they're running something where every 20 minutes it goes and sends a password into that account to try and eventually guess the password, most human analysts, unless you've got a good SIM source solution, are not going to be able to figure out, oh, this is actually like an attack pattern that's running. The premise of an artificial intelligence is that it could take that with other signals intelligence that you're collecting from telemetry in your environment and to make a more sophisticated judgment and say, hey, this is part of a larger attack pattern, and here's how it aligns to MITRE, and here's what we think is going on. And the value there is not that it can do it, because people can do it. The value there is that it can do it at scale, and it can do that initial analysis. And as somebody who's been through a few tarpitting attacks where the threat actor will roll everything at you, like you're getting a distributed denial of service attack, you're getting a ransomware attack, you're getting a data exfiltration attack, and all of that is actually just meant to obfuscate the actual attack that's happening. All of that's just noise and air cover for the actual operation that's going on. I think that's where those companies that don't have the budget and don't have enough staff, which, I mean, honestly, who's got enough budget and enough staff and enough resources, right, do have the potential to use artificial intelligence to supplement and augment those individuals. Now, I'm still on the fence as to whether or not you want artificial intelligence to make a countermeasure. Right. Because often that's part of an incident response plan. And I think that's something that has to be very carefully decided on. Like in some cases, it's a company culture issue more than anything else as to decide, like, when do we actually let the threat actor know that we've detected them? Because in some cases, I don't know if you've seen counterattacks, but they are unpleasant to go through where you find out that, oh, they know that they've been spotted. And so they're going to go a little rage mode. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be on the receiving end of a rampage. And if an artificial intelligence is who kicked it off or what kicked it off, that's not going to look good for anybody involved. But being able to do that large scale data analysis to determine that, hey, there's a larger pattern here that's occurring, I think does have some value. And also it allows people to focus on the more meaningful, harder parts of the job of what do we prioritize out of this attack pattern? And what is the larger meta analysis associated with this, which could go towards either, you know, determining TTPs to try and figure out attribution or being able to actually do indirect attribution or figure out like what is the larger target they're going after, because we're at a point now that there's obviously script kiddies still on the internet. That's fine. But there's folks who've got whiteboards in their office. Like they go in, it's 9 a.m., they go to their targeting meeting and they hear from whoever's in charge, whether it's a criminal or whether it's a government employee, here's your target for the day, go figure out how to go get that, and here's where we're actually going after. The premise of artificial intelligence, setting aside generative AI, is being able to detect that so that you could have better defensive measures, assuming you can do large-scale data analysis.
No, absolutely. And I think this kind of goes into an episode that hasn't aired yet. So I spoke with Kenneth Ellerton. He's from the Ellerton Cyber Academy. So he's an analyst as well. And he kind of went that direction also, saying that it's if it's baked in or if it's added to or if it's just to augment a SIEM SOAR solution, it's worth it. It's a great tool. It takes away the mundaneness. It takes away, for my case, like I'm sitting in a SOC and I'm just staring at what we used to call a Skittle chart. And it's just colors. Yep. There's too many devices. There's too many traps. We don't know what is real and what is not. What's a false positive? And you get frustrated and you kind of just let it go to crap. So to have that backing, to have something in there that can actually kind of filter, like you said, the white noise out to let you know like this is in a actual positive, I think would definitely make it robust. And I guess to that end, if we were to still take the DoD approach, drones don't kill people. There's a person on the on the trigger. There's a lot of artificial intelligence and things of that nature that get the drone to where it needs to be at, but only a human being can make the discernible choice to take action or not. So I guess it should be the same.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then the other thing is that if you think of the parts of GRC that suck or the parts of governance, risk, and compliance that suck, like think of a process by which somebody has to sign a user access review to say, hey, this person should still have access to this thing, right? If you are working with a mature enough user access review process where, first of all, you've automated the determination of who should probably have access and you can do a cohort analysis and drift analysis to figure out like, oh, this person's just rubber stamping their stuff. Eventually, somebody has to look at those signatures, whether they're wet signatures or e-ink signatures. And if you're trying to do evidence sampling, which common enough technique that an auditor would use to find out, is the company actually operating their process here for fictional user access reviews? Why not have an AI do that preemptively? Like, check and see of all the documents that have been signed, of all the attestations that have been signed, whether it's user access reviews, user training, I don't know, maybe somebody signed the policy handbook. Is that actually a human signature? Is that actually their signature? Is that like something that's for realsies or not? Because, again, having that level of confidence and that level of assurance that something checked this so I don't have to spend my day flipping through 1,000 signatures to go, oh, this one isn't their signature, right? First of all, who's got the time? And second of all, who wants to? That's just a boring part of the job. Again, I see that that's not related to that generative AI, but it's absolutely the sort of use case for artificial intelligence where we can make meaningful wins that improve people's lives so they can focus their time on the things that take intelligence and human intelligence and take thought and intention that you can't code into AI.
No, absolutely. And just the simple things is onboarding and offboarding. Like a lot of that is missed as well because you have multiple departments. They all have their own tools. They all have their own timings. They all have their own concerns, right? Mm-hmm. Like the HR might not necessarily care what the config man shop cares about, right? Now you had an account that should have been archived and it's out there doing nefarious things just because this person's been gone for a year, but their account still exists. So, no, that I think those will all be great use cases. So it's good to see that everyone's kind of on the same mindset. Now it's just a matter of time of getting there and building that trust because everybody thinks it's Skynet and it really isn't. But the hallucination thing is real. But again, it comes down to, did you get enough information? So I'm now a member of, what is it? OpenAI. I pay them the monthly subscription. Yeah. I use ChatGPT a lot to just help me with outlining, generating ideas, generating art. So thumbnails, right? Because I'm not the greatest artist and I don't want to spend a half a day making a thumbnail. I want to catch people's attention, right? I can have it generate 5 or 6 thumbnails I can pick between and make tweaks. But most importantly, I don't even know where that was, the train of thought was going, but most importantly, hallucinations. There you go. Because I made a mistake initially upon using it. I opened up a new chat window not knowing that it was not the same conversation. Basically, I had a chat bot I was training to help me with social media posts. I was like, here's my content. This is how I write. Help me to write, you know, within this character limit so I can repurpose content. I opened up a new chat to do something different. I forgot. And I put in a request, but no transcript. I didn't give it my podcast transcript. And it made an episode out of thin air. And it gave it to me. And I was like, I don't remember recording this. Like, you gave me all these social media posts for this episode that doesn't exist. I was like, I don't understand. And then when I looked, I was like, I didn't give you input. I just asked you for an output. And I think that's what people are they're not giving it enough information, and they're getting frustrated mm-hmm. with the results. Like, you have to be as detailed. That's why I think people are going to lose their jobs. Like, when you talk to people who are worried about, like, Sora, like, oh, you know, I make B-roll and I'm going to lose my job because it can do better than me. You understand how to choreograph a shot. You understand what type of lens to use. You understand what a good scene looks like. AI does not. It's just it's making its best judgments based upon previous inputs. But you are such a matter expert, and if you give it all of that information, it will make something better than you could have made it. But I can't do that. Like, I'm not going to take your job and be able to make the best B-roll in the world. So I think that's people's concern. It's not necessarily misplaced, because it's new technology. It's magic until we completely understand it.
It's a new tool. And ultimately, yeah. Like, what differentiates us from most animals, with the exception of crows, for example, and I'm sure you'll get hate mail in the fan notes from other animals that also use tools, but we use tools as a species. That's a thing we do. And I think that right. looking forward, we're hitting that point of demarcation where there are going to be folks who are good at using AI as a tool to do their job, and then there's going to be folks who aren't good at using AI as a tool to do their job. And then folks, jobs where, you know, honestly, AI is not a thing. One of my sons is studying to become an electrician. I do not anticipate AI is going to supplement his job that much, and it's certainly not going to supplant his job until they get AIs that are wandering around and can, you know, wire a house. That's just unlikely.
No, that's very true. I was just talking to, because my two older children are going the clinician route, right? Eldest daughter, she wants to be a nurse. Junior, he wants to be an anesthesiologist. Those jobs are not going to be placed anytime soon. You're going to need people to take care of sick people for the foreseeable future. It's just the tools will become just that more potent.
Right.
You'll be able to detect things better. You'll be able to prescribe things better. Hopefully we'll have medicines that work individually for specific people to cure cancer one day. Mm-hmm. But you're still going to need a human being in these. You just have to be a human being who understands how to describe whatever it is to a prompt, which you do in Google anyway. It's just, now you get to your arts, literature, like these things that you learned in school that you no longer practice, right? Reading and writing comprehension will now come into a greater need within these models, because they understand language very well. So the more descriptive you are, the better the output will be. Garbage in, garbage out. So
yeah. Yes, absolutely. Quite often.
Right. So I'm not terribly concerned. So, but so it's good to see multiple people within this space are also thinking similarly. I can't speak right now.
I think my biggest concern ultimately is that companies that disclose that they're using artificial intelligence and that aren't. Right. I can think of recent lawsuits that the SEC settled against companies that were investment advisors that said they were doing artificial intelligence and that they were going to have AI powered investment advice. And they totally didn't. They were just, that was their marketing team decided, gotcha. Hey, AI is cool. And they got fined like $250,000 each. Now it's a drop in the bucket, but also these were no name investment firms that, you know, I'm waiting to see how this affects a larger company that says, yeah, we're totally doing the AI thing, because that's neat. Like I said, I'm going to RSA. It's going to be all singing, all dancing AI. I anticipate there's going to be a view of it of, is this really AI and can you prove it? And the other part of it I keep thinking about is the case against Carl Lundstrom by CX360, where, if you haven't heard this one, just briefly, it's a risk that most CISOs, I think, didn't have on their risk register, where the salesperson was using AI for chat transcripts from calls, right? So you'd be on a call, you'd need a call transcript. It's handy, it's convenient. I think a lot of people do it. And they were doing this just as part of their day job, doing some kind of tech sales. I don't even know what it was. And then they got terminated from their job. Okay, that happens. And the AI decided to keep joining calls and keep transcribing the calls. And they only found this out afterwards when they asked who the caller was, and it was this artificial intelligence. And now the matter that's of concern is, first of all, how is the AI continuing to be able to join the calls, but also because of somewhat of the murky supply chain around processing and storage of those data? There was highly confidential and sensitive company proprietary information disclosed on those calls. Who's got a copy? Like, right. Who actually can see that? Where was it used for training? Is it going to show up in somebody else's data set? So even though the lawsuit is against the individual salesperson who'd authorized the use of that tool with their account, I think there's a larger question for companies as they look at their acceptable use policies associated with artificial intelligence to say, how would you defend against that? And how would you counsel your employees to either use that appropriately or to not use that? Because I know, like, every video system like Zoom right now, just to pick on an example, has a built-in AI assistant. Right? Is that an acceptable use? Is it okay to describe and discuss company confidential information there without the concern of data leakage associated with confidential information that, you know, could end up in somebody else's training set? That's not a good outcome associated with it. That's kind of the weird compliance angle that we've got in AI right now, where I love the promise of the technology to make people's lives better, but at the same time, there is the underpinning of within reason, right? Within reasonable company use, within reasonable personal use, within ethical use.
Yeah, they're just opening up a much larger attack surface, only because no one reads the user agreement. No one reads anything.
No one has time to read a privacy agreement or a user agreement.
That is something that's coming up in the future. Right? We had a previous episode about that. There is a teacher in Texas trying to build a better model for the user agreement to make it more digestible.
Yep. I've seen a GPT that does that as well, that will read a privacy policy.
So we're getting there, but it's very slow slog. So before I let you go, I know you're a very busy person. I definitely want to pick your brain when it comes to things outside of our careers, right? Things that we do to unwind and things of that nature. I like to land the plane, so to speak, of every
episode. Yeah, yeah.
What are you doing to either unwind? What are your hobbies? Like, what are you doing outside of reading 2,000 reports for your upcoming blog? Because I can't wait to read, by the way.
Yeah. And I'll send you for the show notes the link to the prior one around the 11 factors. The larger cohort analysis, it's on my desk. I hope to get it off my desk this month, as well as that the maturity model for GRC. That's going to be a longer. That's going to be like half. Right. Half this year, I expect.
Just give it a chance. It'll be fine.
Oh, boy. So what do I do outside of work? So it is currently April when we're recording this, and we're coming to the end of what can only be described as a very disappointing ski season. I am a lifelong snowboarder. I tried skiing twice. It did not work out. But I am a lifelong snowboarder, and this was a year where my local mountain had on social media, and I saw firsthand, they were promoting their use of wood chips, because wood chips were something that we were skiing on at times, because there just wasn't enough snow, and wood chips are not great. So what I learned is getting really good headphones, open-ear headphones in my helmet, meant that when I was on wood chips, gravel, scree, and other unpleasant surfaces, I could turn up the music so that I didn't have to hear the inevitable board damage. I also got really good at waxing my snowboards and fixing dents and dings and scratches that inevitably happen this season, because it's just been... Anyway, so the season's wrapping up, so that means that I have now more time to have friends over for board games. I do enjoy a lot of European and somewhat obscure board games. And then beyond that, I am... my friends and I are planning a trip to go to Oregon for winery tasting this summer, because we've never been to the Roseburg area, and so we're going to go hit all the wineries there, and that should be fun, and that should take me forward then to paddleboard season, which is how I spend my summers, is get out on the lake, take an audiobook with me, and take a picnic, and there's 8 hours of a day, just boom, gone, easy.
Got you. No, I definitely get that. So you are in Washington State, correct?
I am, yes. I'm in Bellingham, south of Vancouver, Canada, almost as far north in the Pacific Northwest as you can get.
Got you. So yes, it's beautiful up there. So I only really know the SeaTac area because of we were stationed in Alaska, so we have to go through that area. And I used to live in Idaho, was our first duty station, so we would drive across sometimes if necessary. So beautiful area. Like when it comes to scenery, like it's gorgeous up there. So I could definitely see the paddleboarding and things of that nature. Like actually being out in nature would be awesome. Like here in Florida, nature kill you. So it'll kill you there too. Now, don't get me wrong, but a moose or what have you will get you. But out here, the got gators and all types of nonsense.
Which part of Florida are you in? Because I'm going to be in Orlando later this year in the fall.
So I'm almost directly in between Tampa and Orlando. It's called Wesley Chapel is where I live at. So I'm like 40 minutes north of Tampa and like an hour-ish, hour and 20 from Orlando. So when we go to Disney, it's not that long of a drive.
I will drop you a note when I'm coming to Orlando. I can't remember the dates, but I remember it's in the fall of this year. And it was one of those things where it was like, hey, Kane, do you want to go to Orlando in the fall? And I was like, yeah, it'll be nicer than the weather. I'll be happy to know. I'm sure. Why not?
We go to World of Beer or something like that. So you can try out the local favorites, which are okay.
Yeah, all the beers. Oh, boy. Now you're just we'll do a drafting compliance. I'll bring Tom with me, and you can watch me make beer face at everything. Right.
You're the best IPAs we have to offer you here in the South. But no, I think you'll really enjoy it. Like, Orlando's beautiful. I really do enjoy being here. I'm from Buffalo, New York originally. Like, Buffalo is also beautiful, but it's extremely cold. I'm never going back to being cold, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was cold here for, I think, the longest since I've been here for almost 2-3 weeks. And cold to us is we wake up and it's 50, and then it warms up to 70. Like, so this is, you can't beat this. Like, this is the best ever.
Yeah, so it's beautiful weather compared to I've been in Buffalo in the winter, actually doing consulting, and I had to wonder how I ended up pulling the short straw on that one.
Yeah, you definitely did with all the lake effect snow from Lake Erie. Yes. Oh man,
yeah, it's like Chicago, same time as you get that lake effect snow, and it's just it's -30 is not unheard of.
Right. Yeah, I'm not going back. Like I said, I lived in Alaska as well, so I'm done with the cold. Yeah. So I want to be here, be warm year round. But no, that's awesome. So yeah, definitely let me know, drop me a note when you get closer to the area. But I definitely will continue to keep up with Hyperproof. Like, I really do enjoy talking to you and just checking in on the company. Like, you guys are doing amazing things. And then I did not get a chance to ask you about the character in the background. We'll talk about that next time. I just started that cartoon.
Not Which too long one? Ago. Hell of a Boss or Has Been Hotel?
Has Been Hotel.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. There you go. Yeah, Has Been Hotel. It's a good musical. Some of the strong songs aren't that strong, but I recently watched it on a cross-country flight with a 80-year-old grandmother in the middle row, and she was, you know, peeping on my laptop. I had the sound off. She said it looked like a cute, sweet musical. I was like, great. Yeah. Never mind how many F-bombs they drop per minute in that show. It's fantastic, though. Funny enough, my kids turned me on to it. I really enjoy it, though, as a show.
So I just started it. You're right. They do drop a lot of F-bombs. So I learned very quickly after watching on my own time. But no, it's been great catching up with you. I'd love to have you back on the show as soon as we can, you know, sync up. I know your schedule is pretty busy, but yeah, just again, like to check in with you guys and just see what the future holds. I think you guys, again, are tip of the spear. So when I think of like who's the subject matter expert I should be checking out and following on LinkedIn, I definitely go towards your page as well as some other members of Hyperproof, and just in general, like, your company is doing amazing things. So
thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Like, it was a great experience coming out of the military. I was like, this is a great tool. And then being able to, you know, give what inputs I did give was awesome, because you don't do that in the military. So
that's very true. This is very true.
Right. But no. Please continue to tune in to the episodes. Again, Thursdays at Ask SSP, like this one, where I have interviews with amazing people throughout the industry, subject matter experts as they are. And then Monday, Tuesday, our topics. Wednesday, discussion. Fridays, everything else. So it's more of what we just ended with, where we're talking about movies, books, games, and things of that nature, just trying to unwind for the week before we get to the weekend. And I hope to continue to produce another 500, and I think we're at 62 episodes. So just keep this going. So I'm definitely enjoying it. Hit up all the websites that go by our name, or on all the social medias, either at The Other Side of the Firewall, The Other Side of the FW, or Ask a CISP. You hit me up personally. I'm most responsive on LinkedIn. So that's at RYRY Security Guy. That's RYRY Security Guy. And you can hit me up on all the other platforms as well. And where can they find you?
So you can find me on LinkedIn at Kane McGladrey. So there's only one of me. You will not have any problems on that. Allegedly, I'm still on Twitter or X or whatever that dumpster fire is called. I haven't figured out how to turn it off. And if you want to learn more about Hyperproof, check us out at hyperproof.io. And I'll make sure that you get a link to the, in the show notes to that 11 factors blog about my initial SEC analysis.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, not only for myself, but I'm sure the audience would definitely love to read that as well. So yes, tune into all the things. Stay safe, stay secure.